All right, Leviticus chapter 27. So as we finish up the book of Leviticus, there's a few things that I want you to start thinking about, and these are going to be the next few classes. I want to, first of all, say I think this class will probably run into Wednesday, and that's okay. I was almost anticipating that. If that doesn't happen, then be looking in your emails or be looking in your subscription to TampaBibleTeacher.com to get the next class. As we come to the end of Leviticus, this is the thing I want you to start considering. And we're going to spend some time talking about this. I want you to think of if you were to tell me a story of how Leviticus applies to New Testament Christianity, what would that story look like? And I'm going to repeat that. If I had you tell me a story, imagine I was five. I'm a five-year-old boy, and you have to tell me the story of how Leviticus applies to New Testament Christianity. How would you go about doing that? Those are going to be the next few classes that we start covering. I want us to really understand the pertinence of the law. We're going to spend some time now that we finished Leviticus, or we're about to finish Leviticus, understanding what is the purpose of the law. How did Jesus fulfill the law? And ultimately, what does it mean that Jesus is our high priest? Now that we have all the puzzle pieces together, we're going to make sure that they're all well-fitted and linked so that we can have a better understanding and appreciation of what it is that we're trying to do on this earth, but also what it is that we're trying to do on Sunday mornings as we come together to partake of the Lord's Supper. So that's the direction that I'm headed in the next three or four classes. I haven't mapped out. But I want you to be thinking about that story concept, and I'll explain why that story is important as we move on. But we're going to be in Leviticus chapter 27 today. So Leviticus chapter 27 is been described by many as an appendix or an addition to the end of Leviticus, not saying that it wasn't inspired, but more so it just kind of seems like it's thrown on the tail end of a book. As you get to the end of Leviticus, you can kind of see the pattern, you see the organization, and then it seems like chapter 27 is abrupt, because chapter 27 talks a lot about the vows and what a person is doing as they make vows before God and what the requirements are for the people of God as they are making these vows. So I asked you to read Numbers chapter 29. And for those of you that might not be aware where Numbers is, it's going to be the next book over. So we have Leviticus, and then we're going to go to Numbers chapter 29. Numbers chapter 29, the book of Numbers follows in these few chapters a similar pattern to the book of Leviticus as far as describing some of the offerings and the prescriptions that are given to the priests as far as how they are to offer. So this is following the offerings. Can I get a volunteer, please, to read Numbers 29, 39 through chapter 30, verse 2? Yeah, go ahead. Thanks, Russ.
You shall present these to the Lord at your appointed time, beside your votive offerings and your pre-will offerings, for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings, and for your grain offerings and for your peace offerings. Moses spoke to the sons of Israel and according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And Moses spoke to the head of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the word which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his words. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth."
When we get to this point in Numbers, I think, does a good job of explaining the same question that we might be asking ourselves in Leviticus. Why is there a section on vow or votive offerings following the sacrificial offerings? Why would that make sense in a biblical pattern? Yes.
I don't know if this is the right answer, but it seems to me that a vow is an offering in a sense.
Okay.
And so you're making a vow, and it fits in with the offering situation.
So definitely, The vow in terms of it itself being an offering, it is an offering to God. We've discussed a little bit about votive offerings or these vow offerings already in Leviticus, that they do fit a very similar structure and pattern in terms of there is organization involved. Just because it's a free will offering doesn't mean that you get to come to God however you desire or however you wish. God sets parameters and guidelines for even the votive offerings, the vow offerings that you are making of your own free will. The question that I guess I'm trying to ask is, why, after talking about sacrifices, would God go into talking about vows? Because this pattern is seen outside of Leviticus too. So it wasn't just a one-off deal. We see it in Numbers as well. Michael?
Maybe other than the obvious, one is voluntary and one is obligatory.
Okay.
One is a pattern for the other. Right? You need to be paying attention to that which is voluntary, that which you do with your own free will, with exactly the same emphasis that you do on the ones that I've commanded you to do that are obligatory. So maybe that's part of it, is they're just as important.
So there's a standard or a pattern that is set before us in terms of understanding how God requires us to go through the sacrifice. Look at some of the language here in verses 39 through chapter 30, verse 2 of Numbers, before we get back to Leviticus chapter 27. So again, all these are happening before who? Or who are we presenting these things to in verse 39 of Numbers 29? To the Lord. So these are votive offerings. They follow the burnt offerings, which is a dedication of myself. The grain offerings, which is a dedication of thanksgiving to God. The drink offerings, which shows the fellowship that I share with the Lord. That goes into some of the peace offerings, that I have peace with God. In verse 2 of chapter 30, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. Just think about the normal pattern of your life. Oftentimes, as you go through this sacrificial ritual, as you go through offering a life to God, do you not follow that with a vow of sorts? Do you not follow that with words of dedication? Do you not follow that with something that you are saying before God and maybe even before others? And so I think there's a very naturalistic pattern here, as God in Leviticus chapter 27 has already prescribed all the sacrifice rituals, as he's already prescribed what is required of man when we come to offer these sacrifices, that he would take into account the words that we're going to say, the things that we're giving before him. And then as he would expect us to follow his standard in the sacrifices, he's also going to expect us to do what with our vows? To fulfill them. That's where we're headed to in the remainder of the class, understanding why God takes into account the vows that we're making, the words that we're saying before him. So that's kind of the introduction for us to understand the importance of these things, that God sees our sacrifices in a very similar level as he does our vows or our votive offerings, albeit these are free will offerings, they're not required. So I put a few sentences up here on the board that they're not necessarily important, but they kind of give us an understanding of what we're going to look at in verse 27. Or sorry, chapter 27. These are very definitive. I like that when God talks about the free will offerings, these votive offerings, he still puts these guidelines and parameters before us to kind of give us some direction of what we need to understand clearly. As he gets into the rest of the text here, he starts assigning these values, and he starts talking about inanimate objects or animals versus fields and that sort of thing. And so let's just go through dissecting some of the text here. So what is a vow? Let's start with that. What's a vow? Okay, a promise. A vow was a commitment that's being made before the Lord, before others. So here, God expects us to do what with our vows? Keep them. Even when I make, in verse 2, a difficult vow. God expects me to keep it. We're going to talk a little bit about that too and some of the vows that we see in the Bible. But then we get into the section of value. And the question, I think, would naturally come up, why do different people have different values? Because I thought we were all created equally. I thought we all had a soul that God desired. Obviously, as we've gone through some of the ritual sacrifices, God doesn't require a different value in terms of if you're a male, offer a bull. If you're a female, offer a sheep. If you're a kid, you offer a bird. There are different values in terms of the degree of the sin. If it's a priest who is committing a sin, he is going to have to offer the bull, the costliest animal. But why different values here? Or what is value meaning in this chapter?
From what I gather, brother, it's the degree you can serve the Lord. That's where he expects for you to walk, up to that standard.
Okay, kind of to the degree that you can serve the Lord. It's not so much the degree to which you can serve the Lord. It's the amount of work that you can produce. An adult male was going to produce more work than an adult female, and more work than a child. And that's kind of where the value system comes into place, that it was the amount of work that one could get from you. And so that's where the value came from. The amount of work that you could perform. And it's the same for the field. The fields or the animals were valued in terms of their cleanliness or their uncleanliness, and then how much harvest you could produce either before or up into the year of Jubilee. So that's where the value idea comes in mind. And it has nothing to do so much with God seeing more worth in a male than a female, or more worth in an adult than a child, but rather the amount of work that you could actually produce. So, is there a New Testament concept that would probably teach something a little different than we're all required to do the same thing, the same amount of work? Okay, what do you mean by the widow's mite? So the high priest, I think it was the Pharisees or the Sadducees, but one of the religious leaders is coming in devouring the widows' houses. And in that context of the them coming in and devouring the widow's houses, this one widow gives everything that she has. And obviously that is celebrated by the Lord because she is willing to part with everything, whether it be because she felt she had a lot of faith in God or because it was going to happen anyway because the religious leaders were going to come and take it. I heard something else. The talents. Describe to me what you mean by the talents.
Well, we all have different gifts. Some, you know, teaching,
okay.
Some of hospitality.
Okay. So that idea of us given different gifts, is that a New Testament concept? Do you see that elsewhere besides a parable of the talents that Jesus would have prescribed? Yeah, Aaron? Okay. So we have different parts of the body. And Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, Ephesians chapter 4, in that section, verses 11 through 13, talks about some of us being given as apostles, teachers, prophets, evangelists. And here's my point. Like, God looks at us in a very similar way that he's describing here in Leviticus chapter 27. He values us, or the degree to which we are to offer service to God is going to be based off of what we've been given. And to me, it goes back to this concept that he starts off in chapter 27 by saying, this is going to be, when a person makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. I want us to think really hard, and this is more of a self-examination, self-reflection question. What is it that you are really offering to God? And have you really presented your best to God? If a priest was going to come and give a valuation of your life, would that coincide with what you've been presenting to God? So if somehow God would send a priest to you and he looked at you, what would be required of you? Did you grow up in a Christian household? Did you grow up in a faith household? Are you a third, fourth generation Christian? Would God require more of you than he would a new convert, per se? Maybe. I don't really know. But I think it's good for us to reflect on this idea of valuation. What am I really giving to God? What have I vowed to give to God? Because ultimately, and this is going to be one of the questions we cover, is if you are a Christian here this morning, you have vowed to dedicate your life to God. So what you thought at one point was yours, you recognize and realize it's not yours anymore. Therefore, it's given over to God for service to God. Questions or comments through verse 2? Yeah, Aaron? That's a good point, yeah. That's an excellent point. I like that. I like that a lot. The valuation continues. It's a continual process. That's a great point. Other questions, comments? So this next question is probably my favorite verse because it applies the most to maybe my thinking or my logic in verse 10. So according to verse 10, what is an individual not allowed to do with a clean animal? Switch it out with another. And if he tries to switch it out with another clean animal, if he says, no, you can't have, you know, Betsy over here, you can have Pat over here, what's going to happen? I hope that's, I was just choosing random names. I'm not, all right, I'm still learning the names here, so I'm not trying to offend anybody. What happens if you try to switch out clean for clean?
They're both clean.
You got to give both of them to God. I love this verse because just put yourself in this situation. Maybe this has happened to you. Maybe it hasn't. You've made a vow to God. You said, because you were driven by emotion or you were driven by the situation at that time, God, from this moment on, I'm going to do this. God, you know what? It's been a rough week. I've just been caught up in sin. The lesson really got to me this morning. So God, look, from here on out, every day, I'm going to read my Bible. God, for every day from now on, I'm going to pray. I'm going to make sure that the sun doesn't set until I've gone to you in prayer. Have any of us ever done vows like that, emotionally driven vows? I'm sure we have. Then what happens when your emotions kind of sober up a little bit? You're like, ah, man, I didn't really mean every day. What I meant, God, was this. And I'm still going to give you something good. Like, I might not read my Bible every day, but when I read my Bible, man, I'm going to make sure I have a pencil and a Greek lexicon, and I'm going to go have this preacher on the phone with me, and then it's going to be an amazing amount of studying. But it's not going to be every day. And this is why I find these verses so interesting. God knows our character, and he knows our heart. And he understands that at times we might make difficult vows that he still expects us to fulfill. And here's what I think is so interesting and revealing about my life. Oftentimes when I've made the difficult vow, that was the right vow to make. That was what I should have been doing in the first place. Whatever I chose to offer to God in that moment was most likely the right thing to offer to God. So in that moment, someone says, God, you deserve my best. You're going to get Betsy over here. Because this is the best I have to offer. And then you sober up and you're like, ah, you know what? Like, that's my prize-winning heifer. I don't know that I really want to give that to God. God, I'm going to give you another one that's very comparable. You know, here's Pat. God says, no, like, don't do that. In fact, when you try to do that, I get both. It makes me really conscious of what I'm saying. It makes me really conscious of what I'm presenting to God. And this is what I wrote in my Bible when I got to this verse. My calculated feelings, my calculated decisions are usually wrong. Not to say it's not good to think about what you're doing, but oftentimes when I've had time to really calculate things, that's probably when I'm trying to get by with something, and that's not what God desires of me. And for at least my life, that's probably not the right thing that I should be offering to God. Questions or comments through verse 10? Yes, Daniel. I had a friend who was going out of town. He was going to go out of the country, and he asked, you know, can I like send my money through PayPal or something like that on a weekly basis while I'm out of town? And I said, like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know that we have a PayPal account for the congregation. This was not here. This is another congregation. And I told him, I was like, just set the money aside. Like, if you know you're going to be gone for a month, take whatever you were going to contribute for the month and set it aside. Leave it with someone or give it to someone. And, you know, it can be contributed. If you desire on a weekly basis, just, you know, give it to them. They'll give the check that week, or you can give it in a lump sum. And I'm not here to talk about whether that's biblical or not. But I told him the point was set your money aside. And he said, oh, I'll just do it when I get back. And I was like, no, that's not the right approach. I was like, because what's going to happen, because I know what happens, you get vacation happy. And you start buying things, and you start eating out, and you start spending frivolously that money that maybe was set aside for God. And you say, well, I'm just going to take a little bit more from that. And then whatever's left over, that's what God gets. Do we often give God our leftovers? Unfortunately, yes. Oftentimes, we think of God last, even if we thought of him first, which is kind of ironic. But that's the way we are. And so it's very appropriate for us to consider, what does it mean to give God my best? And what does it mean to set these things aside for God? What have I portioned for God? Because I understand he's given me these blessings already. So other questions or comments?
Brother.
Yes. Can't read that yet. We're getting there. No, go ahead. Go ahead. So Ecclesiastes 5. I'm actually in the mic because
this is the one I always go to with vows. When people say they're going to do something, he says, "When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. Better not to vow than to vow not to pay."
Amen. Amen. Again, that passage comes from Ecclesiastes 5, another Old Testament book. From written by the wisest man to have ever lived. Joseph, did I hear your voice?
You're very well familiar with Jephthah. He made this vow in Judges 11. He says, "Whatever comes, if you give me victory over the Amorites, whatever comes out my door, I will sacrifice it to you, O Lord, if you give me victory." And his daughter came out the door.
Yeah, so Jephthah, one of the judges, makes an irrational vow, or a rash vow is what I should say. And then he ends up paying that vow. So we're going to look at some of those examples, but again, just, I like verse 10 a lot because I think it would apply to most of us in this room. It definitely applies to me. What is being vowed in verses 14 through 24? A field. Now, again, the field is given or place valuation based off how much work can be garnered from it, how much harvest it can produce. You also have a house being vowed in verses 14 through 15. Before you get to the field in verses 16 through 24. Again, you can dedicate these things to God like you could dedicate an unclean animal to God, but if you try to redeem it, you are paying back its value plus 20%. And that follows the same pattern as the guilt offering that we already took time to study. If you were wronging someone, you had to pay it back to them plus 20%. So I don't know what the significance of the one-fifth or the 20% might be, but that's what God requires, even in the redemption of something that's been consecrated to God. So this leads us, questions or comments to verse 24. There's a lot of things I'm not necessarily covering, but that's okay. Yeah, Ross?
Where would that money go?
It would go to the temple treasury, or it would be placed to be set aside still for the Lord. So it wasn't just free money. It was given to maintain the temple, pay the priests, that sort of thing. So, good question. Other questions? Through verse 24. Verse 26. According to verse 26, why can't an individual vow a firstborn? That to me was interesting. I had to look up this verse because I couldn't remember where this verse was or where this law was. But it actually comes from Exodus chapter 13. God speaking to Moses says this to his people: "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offering of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. It belongs to me." God is making a statement here that I find difficult to understand, but I can understand the application of it. You can't give a firstborn or dedicate a firstborn to God because God has already said it, already said that belongs to me. And here's the principle behind the votive offerings. This is what chapter 27, as well as any of the free will offerings, are all about. God's people were not supposed to just try and get by. That's the point. God's people were not trying to just get by. So what that means is, well, I want to offer an offering to God that's of my free will. So God, here's a firstborn. I'm giving you an offering. And God is saying, you can't do that because it already belonged to me. You can't offer, and these are some of the verses we skipped, a house or a field that's already been sold to someone else and say, "Hey, I sold this to brother so-and-so, but now I'm going to dedicate it to you." God says that's not how it works. You're not just trying to get by. You're not just trying to mark off a box. You're not just trying to cross out something. But give to God something that is a true sacrifice. And I've shared this verse with you, but I want to go back to reading it because it appears twice in the Bible. I want you to go to 2 Samuel 24 and verse 24. So I want to put in context what's happening here. And this is, again, one of my favorite verses in the Bible. It also appears in 1 Chronicles chapter 21. But David has sinned. David is going to go before God to repent of this sin. And God instructs him to go and buy this field. So this guy named Arunah is a great guy. He hears what David's trying to do. And he says, so David says to him, I'm here in verse 21 to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar before the Lord that the plague may be held back from my people. Arunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, and the yokes of oxen for the wood. Everything, O king, Arunah gives to the king. And Arunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. So, what does this guy want to do for King David? He wants to give him everything. He says, look, just take it. This is yours. You're going to give it to God? Here, it's free. It's yours. I want you to think of times in your life where something like that has happened. You've thought of what you want to do for the Lord. You've set aside something for the Lord. You've taken time to be very meticulous and say, look, I want to give a real dedication or a real portion of something to God. So I'm going to do that. And we'll use this in terms of money. Maybe you decided, a need came up in the congregation, and you decided, look, I can give $1,000 towards this need. And so you prepare your $1,000 to give towards this individual who has a need. Before you get there, you find out the need's already been met. So what do you do with $1,000? Maybe you're like, hey, here's $100. And they're like, wow, I wasn't expecting that. And you're like, yeah. I know. I'm super good, right? So I've put myself in this situation multiple times. And maybe this is why it's one of my favorite verses. And I think the term here is pull an Aaron. That's what I've heard. So I'm going to try not to pull an Aaron here and get really emotional. However, the king said to Arunah, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price. For I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. Someone remind me, what is a burnt offering? In Leviticus. That's all the way back to chapter 1. That was the first thing we talked about. What is a burnt offering symbolic of?
Price.
Sorry?
Price.
Okay, you said price? Kind of. So there's different values to a burnt offering. You could offer a bull, you could offer a goat or a lamb, or you could offer birds. What does a burnt offering represent? It represents, and I'm going to give you all some grace here, because I know some of you were not here for the first class, and that's okay. A burnt offering represents giving yourself to God. That's the first thing that we discussed in chapter 1 of Leviticus. Giving yourself to God. Giving your life to God. The burnt offering was completely consumed. The burnt offering was completely consumed, and that was representative of your life. Your life, when you brought the burnt offering before God, was completely gone. It is no longer yours. It belongs to the Lord. So here, it's interesting to me that he talks about the burnt offerings. And he says, I can't do that. I can't give to God my life when I haven't really done anything to pay for the wrong that I've committed. And so he says, I refuse to give to God that which costs me nothing. Now go back to Leviticus chapter 27, physically or mentally, and make the application here. God says, you can't give me what's already mine, because it's not really a sacrifice. You can't give me a field that you've already sold to someone else, because it's not yours. Why is chapter 27 applicable to us? Because it's another reminder that our land, our time, our words belong to God. And God is trying to keep them in this mindset. You give back to me what I've given to you. And perhaps one of the most simple concepts and yet difficult concepts for us to grasp is give me your life. Because that came from me too. And that's what I want from you. I want your life, your words, your time. The things that I've given you, that's what I require of you. And God has done that. God gave us life. When I had no life, I was dead in my sins and trespasses. God, being rich in love and mercy, gives me life. So, verse 33 of chapter 27 of Leviticus. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. For if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. There's our theme for Leviticus. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments. I like that the book ends by saying these are the commandments. It doesn't say traditions. It doesn't say customs. And I think a lot of times that's how we approach a lot of the Old Testament or even parts of the New Testament. That was the tradition. That was the custom. When God said to the rich young ruler, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Well, he was talking about a tradition or a custom. That was a commandment from the Lord. And so here, God says, I've given you a commandment that the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel on Mount Sinai. So, God says, do this, follow these statutes, follow these guidelines. Now flip over to Numbers chapter 1. Numbers chapter 1. And we're going to close with this. You follow the Lord's commandments. You do what the book of Leviticus says. You consecrate yourselves and make yourself holy as God is holy. Then, what happens in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1? Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai. What's the word? In the tent of meeting. Why is that significant? Because the book of Exodus ended with Moses where? Outside of the tabernacle. Outside of the tent of meeting. He ended in Exodus outside. He goes through Leviticus. We describe Leviticus as removing the sandals. And now he gets to be in the presence of God. He is in the tabernacle. Does the book of Leviticus work? Does the book of Leviticus work? Absolutely. This is one of the coolest books in the Old Testament because God says, you do what I've asked, how I've asked, and you will get to be in my presence, and I will get to be in your presence. The book of Leviticus works. So, that's our study of Leviticus. We're going to discuss a few more things about the vows. If you Look online, these questions. I have three more questions that I want to discuss, Lord willing, on Wednesday. But any final questions or comments for today? All right, if not, I hope these thoughts will go with you this morning as we enter into our worship service. I hope you will think about the lengths and the extents that God went through so that he could put his holy presence in your life and you could consecrate and dedicate yourself to him. At this time, we are dismissed, and I finally finished the class before the second bell. So it only took like 21 classes, right?